This episode of the Flush Podcast is brought to you by Federal Premium Ammunition and by Onyx Hunt, the number one GPS hunting map app. Onyx, know where you stand. Today we're talking upland birds in the Northwoods, specifically ruffed grouse and woodcock. Bailey Peterson is my guest. She's a wildlife biologist for the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources and an active member of both the Ruffed Grouse Society and the American Woodcock Society. Bailey's a bird dog loving hunter that will help us understand her favorite birds and her project to ban them. Welcome to another episode of the Flush Podcast. I'm Travis Frank. I'm your host. Brandon Morton, as always, is our producer. Before we get started today, I want to thank all of you that sent us messages saying that you've purchased our Flush hats and buffs. Again, if you missed last week's podcast, you can go back and listen to it. But we announced that we have Flush hats and buffs now available for purchase. And all the proceeds are going straight to Pheasants Forever and Quail Forever's Call of the Uplands Habitat campaign. I want to make a note, though, that we ordered only a limited supply of these hats and buffs, so once they're gone, they're gone. To order your hat or buff, just go to our website at theflush.tv. Also, many of you have been asking us about ammunition. It's one of the hottest topics in the hunting and shooting world these days. Well, I'm happy to announce that Federal has joined our lineup of podcasts with their own show called It's Federal Season. This means that Brandon, our producer, is even busier than normal, and it means that you will be able to get information directly from Federal in their podcasts. Listen, laugh, learn. Every It's Federal Season podcast pulls from Federal's nearly 100 years of ammunition manufacturing. Get the latest news, tips from their team of ambassadors, technical information from in-house experts, and so much more. Search for It's Federal Season wherever you get your podcast to listen to that show for yourself. Lately, I've had a lot of interaction with you, our listeners. I thank you all for sending in the emails and messages, and I hope that you'll keep them coming. One thing that I've been doing lately is after I answer the questions, I like to ask people that send me notes what I can do to make this podcast better or more enjoyable for them. I've received a lot of really good feedback, which has led me to want to add kind of a segment, which I don't have a name for yet, to each episode. Basically, I'm going to discuss one or two of the questions each week, talk about the timely news topics, give gear reviews, food advice, really anything that pops up on the radar for that particular week, generated mostly from you. So please keep reaching out to me, sending us messages. You can find us on any of our social channels, or you can send them directly to me. Again, if you go to our website, there's a contact form, and I will get your email sent to me. So here's the first question sent by Tony Teague. How do you guys choose a pointing dog for rough grouse with the hopes of one day hunting wild pheasants as well? Now, before I answer this question, I want to introduce my guest today because I think she can add quite a bit of advice to this question herself. Bailey Peterson, thank you for taking the time today to join us. I know you're very, very busy. But Bailey, here's my take on this particular question. I've hunted with many, many different breeds of dogs in many different habitats for birds. And one thing that always it holds true is that when I'm hunted behind a dog, it doesn't matter if they've smelt a chucker or a grouse or a pheasant before, they seem to know instantly that's an upland bird. And if you're a pointing breed, you're going to stop and point that bird. If you're a flusher, you're going to go right to it. So I feel like choosing a pointing dog for rough grouse with the hopes of one day hunting wild pheasants, really, that dog will hunt both, or whatever bird you take it to hunt, or whatever habitat you bring that dog into. It's really whatever position you put that bird into. Bailey, do you feel like there's a certain breed for rough grouse that would not hunt wild pheasants?
That's a good question. I think if you bring up a pointing dog to hunt rough grouse, and that's mainly the kind of context they're getting, they're already used to trailing like a running bird. We know rough grouse run in the North Woods. I think the way rough grouse run versus the way pheasants run is a little bit different. I wouldn't want to go the other way. I think you're going to struggle if you have a really good pheasant hunting pointing dog. You're going to maybe end up getting a little bit too close to those birds that don't handle the pressure as well. I think that the pheasants tend to run to either out of a cover or to a specific objective, such as like a really thick clump of something, and then they hold tight in there. Or that's my experience anyway. Whereas your rough grouse isn't going to have that, you know, little thick clump of grass that the dog can get kind of right up into and point. There's also different kinds of pointing dogs. So your tracking type dogs are maybe going to put their nose down and run right into those birds, or they have to learn how much scent is too much or just enough to stop. Whereas you have another kind of subset of pointing dog where they are always pointing right on the bird, or they don't go on point until they hit that bird scent. So I guess it really just depends, but I think you'd be more all right to go with a dog that hunts rough grouse most of the time and pheasants later
in life. So once they understand the, you know, the obedience part of training and they work into wild birds, I think from, you know, the dogs that I've hunted with over the years and even variety of habitats and terrains and different birds, I'm always just amazed. That dog that I've walked behind in the grouse woods can point a chucker on top of a mountain and it knows instantly, or a Hungarian partridge or a pheasant. It's like they adapt so quickly because of their natural abilities and instincts. And I'm sure there's probably a learning curve with it, but I don't know that I know anybody that specifically gets a dog breed that wouldn't want them to hunt other kinds of upland birds, right?
You're right, yeah. I mean, I can't think of an instance or somebody that does, unless you live in a really specific habitat type, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Well, I don't know if that answers the question for Tony or not, but I think the breed really depends on the research you put into that breed and then the time you spend with them and the habitat, terrain, and the birds that you're going to work with them are going to create kind of your hunting bond together. And hopefully that dog can hunt in a variety of different scenarios, terrains, locations, and different birds as well. So how to choose is you choose the dog that really feels right to you, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Bailey, I know that's not the typical way that I introduce guests to the show, so I'll work through this how to answer questions. But I think there's a lot of information out there that people want to learn, and maybe that's the reason why they listen to hunting-related podcasts. Certainly, you have a lot of information that a lot of hunters would hope to understand. So you work with the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. You're a wildlife biologist. Is that correct?
Correct. Yep. My title is the Assistant Area Wildlife Manager. So I work up here on the North Shore of Lake Superior. And my work area is kind of the counties that border Lake Superior.
Gotcha. How long have you worked for the DNR?
Oh, I've been with the DNR almost 12 years. I've been up north here in Two Harbors for 6.5 now.
Gotcha. No, this is kind of personal, but why did you choose that career?
Oh, that's a great question. I always spent a lot of time outside as a kid. And I was kind of a nerd growing up, and I ended up going to a school down in the cities for middle school. It had just opened up, called the Math and Science Academy. And I was always really more keen on the kind of more biological type sciences. And I knew I wanted to go into some sort of science. I just didn't know what. And in high school, I had moved up north into the Brainerd Lakes area. And I'd taken an advanced forestry class, and I got to watch rough grouse on drumming logs for the first time. And we went to Camp Ripley and met up with the DNR biologists, the research biologists there, and watched them like pull bears out of the dens and things like that. And that just kind of sealed it for me. I knew I wanted to be a wildlife biologist then.
Gotcha. So if you could go back and do it all over, would you still choose to be a biologist?
I think so. Yeah, specifically wildlife, for sure, I think.
Gotcha. How does your love for hunting influence your role with the DNR today?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it definitely helps me to be able to answer the questions that I receive from the public in terms of our kind of complicated license structure, where to hunt, how to hunt. I really enjoy as much as I can teaching new hunters the what, whys, hows, and whens. And I also enjoy, I mean, we get a lot of people coming that don't live up on the shore that come and visit during the hunting season specifically. So if, you know, a family calls and they're going to be camping at one of the parks here along the shore and they want to maybe grouse hunt while they're here, I may be an oversharer of information on where to do that and or how, just because it is such a passion of mine. Mm-hmm. And I think we have so much public land up here that I'm not really concerned about stepping on toes or that they might show up in the cover that I'm going to be hunting that morning.
Gotcha. So what came first? The love for biology and then this role working with the DNR or hunting? Did you hunt before you started doing this for a career?
So I started hunting late in college with some friends, primarily waterfowl hunting and really not upland hunting at all. But I started upland hunting after I got hired on by the DNR. I just had a few coworkers that knew a lot about it, and they didn't take me out. They would have happily taken me out if I asked. It's just not really my personality type. I more like to figure things out on my own, I think. And so my husband and I kind of learned together, I would say. We weren't married back then, but once we did get married, we got ourselves a dog, a golden retriever, and we started hunting mainly waterfowl still, but branching out into the uplands more and more as the opportunities arise.
So which one would you choose if you have a free day? What are you going to hunt for?
Well, today, I mean, now at this time in life, probably definitely grouse and woodcock.
Okay. What is it about those two birds that draws you in, that keeps you wanting to come back?
Oh, that's such a good question. It's difficult to answer too. The woodcock is not a difficult bird to pursue. They're not hard to find once you know a lot about their habits and habitats. But they're such a neat and unique bird, I think, that I'm just always drawn to them. And rough grouse I do find to be a challenging bird to pursue. I don't think I'll ever stop thinking that. They're just kind of a fascinating bird. You're constantly getting outsmarted by them, mm-hmm. at least here in the Great Lakes.
Right. But they don't call him the king for nothing, right? The king of upland birds. I mean, it's kind of like the ultimate prize when you take one behind a dog. You know, I mean, two ways to hunt them, right? People go on trails, four-wheelers, drive trails or walk trails, see them out on the trails and bag them that way, or people that follow their dogs and take them on the wing. And I feel like the challenge in the cover that those birds put themselves in and how they just know when to flush when you're least ready to take a shot, it just never seems to fail.
And the dogs are so much better at their job than I am at holding up my end of the bargain, but I can have a little bit of excuses here in the Northwoods when it's as thick as it is.
Right. What kind of dogs do you hunt with today?
Right now I have a 6-year-old small Munsterlander. So he's a versatile pointing dog. And I have a 2-year-old Llewellyn setter. And then I've got a 12-week-old puppy, another setter too.
Oh, fantastic. So the interesting thing, I mean, we were talking yesterday about a different project that you're working on, which is the spring banding. And I know you did a video with Project Upland and you've talked about this on other podcasts before, but what is the spring woodcock banding project that you do? And we'll dig into this, but what is the project first?
So it's woodcock banding. It's similar to like waterfowl banding that's been going on for many decades as well, but this is just a smaller bird and a smaller group of kind of diehards that are out there doing it. Waterfowl banding is usually done either by universities or by professional agencies, whereas this is a volunteer activity where we fall under a permit, a master permit holder, and so the sub-permittees or the banders all go out independently with our dogs who have been checked off or tested, and we're looking for a hen who will have had a full clutch, would be 4 eggs. So you can never find a woodcock with more than 4 chicks, but ideally you're going to find a hen with 4 chicks on the ground, and you can ban them in the springtime. You only get about a 2-week window to do it.
Where specifically do you band?
Well, you know, in Minnesota, we have our snow we have a lot of snow up here on the shore. And so I band pretty much from like the Brainerd area. So kind of north central, north to the border. It kind of extends my season if I'm able to travel. And so I kind of go everywhere that I can that's, you know, good woodcock cover.
Gotcha. So what have you learned since you started banding these birds? Do you get people that harvest them maybe down in like Alabama or something that call them in? I mean, have you ever had any birds you've banded get called in?
Yes, I have had birds I banded get harvested. However, the harvest rate is, I think it's about 75% or higher of the banded birds are harvested within 1 mile of where they were banded. And that's for woodcock. Hmm. Waterfowl bands are probably a little bit different, but it's not surprising, but it's always kind of neat when you get either a older bird that's been harvested. I think we've had birds that were 7 years old harvested. That's always a little more special, I think, than the 3/4 of a year old birds that are harvested. Because that's really more what you see. And then if they're harvested on the wintering grounds, that's another kind of bonus, but it doesn't happen all that often. In Minnesota, our return rate is rather low. We're trying to grow. Michigan has a much more, it's just been around longer, their program has, and they have a lot more volunteers. So they get a lot more bans on birds than we do. And so they have, you know, a pretty solid set of data, whereas ours is continuously growing. And just as an example, like our return rate is like 3-4% in Minnesota, whereas in like up in northern Minnesota, up in Cass County, we have a band return rate of 11%. So it's much higher. That's where we have our banding workshop at Pine Ridge Grouse Camp up there. And so a lot of us, we're taking out our new banders or our hopeful new apprentices out during our banding workshop in the spring, we're all on the public lands up there, which kind of sets up for more success of, somebody harvesting a bird up there in the fall.
So when you say you have 11% return success, does that mean of the birds that fly south, you're going to get 11 that come back to the same area? And
it just means 11% of the birds that are banded, we get somebody harvest a banded bird. So it's pretty low. It's really quite low, but it falls in line with what you'd expect for any migratory species that's banded. Okay.
Now, when they go south, do you know how far Minnesota's woodcock travel?
Yeah, the majority of the woodcock in Minnesota end up wintering in Louisiana and possibly very far east Texas.
Okay. Do they all come back to Minnesota, or is there any research that shows that some of the birds might end up in Michigan or Canada or somewhere else?
That's a good question. The out east, they're doing a GPS tracker research project, and that's really awesome. It's pretty state of the art because it's such a small bird to put a GPS transmitter on. But those birds are usually returning where they think they should, although they make some interesting stopovers or movements, and sometimes they do end up in other places. What we know from like recapturing hens that we banded as chicks or just there's a lot of studies in Minnesota done by universities that deal with woodcock as well. They're just they're a unique bird, but they're also sort of a sensitive species. And so we do study them a lot. And we know that most birds return back to where they nested the year prior. And most chicks will, if they make it through their first season, will return back to where they were hatched and try to fight for territory near that area.
Gotcha. Have you learned anything about their migration route that surprises you? And when I say that, I did a banding project with the Minnesota DNR probably 10 years ago, maybe even a little bit longer than that. It was sometime after the Gulf oil spill. And they were trying to understand where the loon migration from Minnesota took those birds and their route. And one thing that they found out, but it was a GPS study. So one thing that they found out was that the loons in Minnesota, they don't travel straight south. They actually go to the Great Lakes first, over to like Lake Michigan area, and then they head south. And the adults leave first. All the chicks stay back. The adults leave, they go to the Great Lakes, then they fly straight to the Gulf. And when they come back up, then they come back to Minnesota's lakes. But the chicks don't leave until way later in the fall, which is kind of interesting. And like their parents just abandon them. So they've learned a lot about those birds that I find interesting. Do you find anything that kind of, you're like, that's just a little bit ridiculous about woodcock?
Yeah, it's another good question. The thing about woodcock, well, it's similar to loons. They're really pushing the envelope in terms of weather. I mean, the reason they migrate over to the Great Lakes, like you were saying, is probably because they're facing freeze up on the lakes that they're probably currently inhabiting. And that's what we see with woodcock as well. But I mean, not because the water's freezing, but because the ground is either freezing or they're getting precipitation and the, snow. They're getting snow and they can't feed anymore. This is a species that the majority of its diet is earthworms that they dig out of, one beak or bill's length deep in the soil. And so they need to be able to probe into the soil to get food. And so they're constantly pushing the envelope as far as weather. They want to stay up here as long as possible. What affects their migration is, quality habitat at their stopover points, as well as weather. If they have a good weather window, the study over in out east has shown that they can make extremely large movements in one night, or sometimes if the weather's unfavorable, they may only move like a dozen miles or something, or they might just stay somewhere for a good while, and then you might know that they have a good chunk of habitat that they're sitting on. There's always conjecture in the fall. You'll hear people say that they shot a migrant or a bird that probably came down from Canada because it was really big, or no, it's just still all local birds because they're kind of small and skinny. It's just really hard to know for sure. Of course, if it is a banded bird and it was shot in, the last weekend of the season, then we would say, wow, that one stuck around for a while. Or if it was a banded bird that was shot, down during in a southern state's hunting season, that while our hunting season is still open up here, we would say, wow, that was a pretty early migrant. But it's so weather dependent for those birds.
Do you know how far their range is up into Canada, the woodcock?
I don't know how far it is, but it is limited by the type of cover that they prefer. So anything up into the shield that's more of that spruce dominant cover type is not going to be what they prefer. It really prefer the aspen and other thick brush type species, deciduous.
So how did you get into this banding project? Because this is in addition to your role at the Department of Natural Resources, correct? I mean, this is a volunteer role.
Correct. Yep. It's not related except that I was working here when I found out about it. That's all. I have a coworker, she works in fisheries, and she has a small Munsterlander as well. And so I was messaging with her when I first got my dog, and she was like, wait, you're gonna make it a banding dog, right? And I was like, I don't know, tell me about it. And I had already kind of become obsessed with the woodcock. When I first got out of college, I worked for the University of Minnesota on a woodcock project. And I didn't really know anything about that bird prior to that, because like I said, I hadn't been a hunter. And besides an ornithology class, seeing this kind of weird looking bird, I didn't know anything. And so I was able to have this technician job with the U, which is a field-based job. It was kind of a dream to spend all late nights and early mornings on the singing ground, capturing woodcock and putting radio transmitters on them. And so then this opportunity came up, and I had a dog. That's was my training goal from the start with that dog, was get it as many birds as possible and get it steady. So our woodcock banding dogs have to be steady through the flush and essentially through the shot and through the fall, because what happens when a female or hen woodcock is trying to lure you away from her nest or her chicks is she's going to bounce up in the air kind of half of a flush. She's not going to flush and wing away like you might see during the fall. She'll only go up, 10, 15, 20 feet, and then kind of do what we call it a flutter flight, come back down, but she only might have gone less than 10 yards. And then she might kind of dance around there, pretend like she has a broken wing or a broken leg to try to draw you away from her. I mean, those babies that she just hatched is such a huge energetic commitment, and the their only goal is to produce or reproduce more birds. So she's trying really hard to lure you away, and so you have to have a dog that is able to resist all those temptations. They have to stand steady, and we remove them from temptation after we see a hen. We'll pick them up and move them back in time to a tree, or have them move them back and have them lay down. But it is just critical that the dogs are able to be trained to that level where they resist that temptation. And so it was tough. And I had a lot of people help me along the way, but I was able to get it done with my first dog. And so now it's really, we call it the catch and release season, but it's, to me, it's just as fun and just as, or definitely more rewarding than the fall time for sure.
I bet. I mean, one, you're able to have hands on with these birds that are so cool to begin with, but then you get to have that interaction with your dog. I mean, it really does sound like a catch and release hunting season. And I know
it is.
That it's really work oriented to it, but it's like you're going out on a hunt, right? I mean, you're going into the same habitats that you would go to in the fall, right? And you just start walking. You've got this kit with you that you take, I assume, and you band all these birds right there, and then you set them back in and walk away. Is that pretty much the deal?
Yep, yeah, exactly. So we carry our supplies in our vest, and they're pretty minimal. A couple of mesh bags. The bands are obviously really small because they're pretty small bird. And then the banding pliers, and then a small small measuring stick for measuring their bills. That's how we determine how old they are. And then just a tiny little clipboard and our data sheets to keep all of our information straight. It's pretty important to keep our band numbers straight.
Gotcha. So then where does that information go after you document everything? Where do you submit that information to?
That's a good question. It goes to our master permit holder. He'll receive all of our information and data sheets. I have a coworker in the DNR and she kind of keeps track of all the data, as far as like our data points and all of our banding locations. But ultimately, all of our banding information gets sent to the bird banding laboratory out east, and that is gonna kind of be the database for. They'll receive the data from us, but the website where you go to report a bird is that's on the band is I think it's just report.gov, and you go on there, and any member of the public or citizen, or I guess I should just say hunter who shoots a banded bird, they're going to go on to that website and enter the band number, and then they'll find out all the information about that bird that we kind of put in there when we banded it.
Gotcha. So you mentioned earlier that you guys have that you mentor other hunters or banders, or I'm not sure what title you give them, but this is something that happens at Pine Ridge Grouse Camp each spring. How do people sign up for it, get into this group? And I assume it's a pretty small group, kind of intimate, to really make sure that the birds' welfare, their safety is number one priority.
Yeah, correct. Absolutely. The bird welfare is the number one priority. We get a lot of people interested. We have a lot of people, something around a dozen or more per year that take the course. And you have to get your hands on birds and run through the whole program and have your dog checked off. And you can get all that done at the workshop every year up at Pine Ridge. But for one reason or another, people are busy in the spring, and the workshop is always pretty much always held on fishing opener here in Minnesota. So it does. People are busy. And so we gain a few new banders every year. They have to go through, like I said, the apprenticeship, which is a full season or more of banding with a mentor. And so, yeah, as part of becoming a bander, it's pretty much a given that you're going to be taking other people out once it's time to do your kind of due diligence and contribute to doing that as well. And if we can spread ourselves out across the state, it makes it a little bit easier to help grow the program like we're trying to do.
Gotcha.
And yes, we post it, you know, Pine Ridge will post it every spring or every winter when the dates get set. But it is kind of by word of mouth. There's not a super great way that we know of to kind of advertise for it at this point in time, but we're working on it.
Well, it sounds like you just advertised a few thousand bird hunters here right now. So I guess if people wanted to learn more information about it, or they're interested in it, where should they go?
The best place to go is probably PineRidgeGrouseCamp.com, just the Pine Ridge website. There's a whole page devoted to the woodcock banding workshop.
Gotcha. Do you ever have a dog that just doesn't, you're like, I'm sorry, I can't let you pass this course. Your dog is not safe to be out there, won't stop. You know, like, does that ever happen?
Yeah, it happens every year. And it's not it doesn't mean you can't become a bander. It just means you have to work through it. And Jerry's so good at, Jerry Havel, the owner of Pine Ridge, at helping people continuously come back and keep training or keep working through it. We have woodcock banders, longstanding banders that have been banding since the 90s that are NAVDA judges, so they can work through it. You know, send them back to NAVDA training nights, or, you know, just work on steadying those dogs up, resisting the temptation. And, you know, we've had people that have to come back multiple years, and that's where the commitment part kind of comes in. If you're committed to getting it done, you know, the birds are going to be there, hopefully. So it just really depends on what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. I found it was interesting when we were talking the other day about how few birds you actually come across, because the way that their nesting season and weather dictates it. What's a normal year for you as far as days in the woods, and then how many chicks you actually get to band?
So I don't have my like logs right in front of me. I spend a lot of time out looking. And in an early season, it's really like, okay, so maybe I let some rules slip a little bit in the fall during the hunting season. We were talking about pheasants earlier. They kind of always lend to me allowing a little sloppier dog work, but we tighten it up real quick in the spring. I'll start on pigeons and then work to the woodcock that are coming back through. And so it's good to know when they come back through, as soon as those males are on their singing grounds, and they usually try to arrive and fight for territory. Once the hens get back shortly thereafter, they're going to start breeding, and they're going to, because they only lay 4 eggs, unlike a ruffed grouse that may lay a dozen or more, they're going to start incubating those eggs after like 4 days. And so it's 21 days from there, you could have chicks on the ground. And so this year, that's really going to be about right now, but not all the birds were even back yet when some of them might have started nesting. So your season can get kind of prolonged by that, but you only have from the day that they hatch until about 12 or 14 days before they're fully flighted. And so then your season is effectively over, or you shouldn't spend a lot of time. It goes back to bird welfare, like chasing those birds around. And so you just move on and try to search another cover for maybe a hen with a younger brood. And so you spend a lot of time in the woods in finding adults, or, you know, maybe finding chicks if you're lucky. I always think if I could get into the double digits of number of chicks banded per year, I'm feeling pretty lucky. And I've gotten there for the most part every year. Last year was my best year. And I think because we had such great spring conditions for nesting, this year isn't looking that good because they already started sitting on nests. And then we got about a week and a half of straight cold rain. I'm a little depressed today because it's been snowing off and on all day. Although I guess I will say I did hear 2 ruffed grouse drumming at lunch. So I guess it's an okay day. But there's so many different factors that play into it. So if you're the kind of person that needs that instant gratification or constant satisfaction, it just depends. You just have to change your definition of success, I guess, because it is a difficult pursuit. But I think that's what keeps us so obsessed. As soon as you hold one of those tiny little 1-2-day-old chicks in your hands, you'd be spending every day looking for them that you can.
Oh, that sounds awesome. Well, it's obviously something that people can become involved with. So now you know how to get hooked up with this. And maybe Bailey will be your mentor. I don't know. Let's switch gears a little bit. You're also active with the Ruffed Grouse Society. What's your role with the Ruffed Grouse Society?
Just personally, not outside of work, as a member. You know, pretty long-standing member, just to support, you know, the mission and the work that they do. Professionally, I'm lucky enough, you know, there's just not a ton of dollars coming in anymore for habitat projects. Or I shouldn't say that, but to be fair, like really specific, species specific habitat projects. So we've developed a really good relationship with the Ruffed Grouse Society in terms of them being able to receive habitat grants and us being able to get some work done on the ground. So I think what we were talking about yesterday is some of the grant opportunities that are available in Minnesota, both the Conservation Partners Legacy Grants and the Lessard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council, where the Ruffed Grouse Society and other habitat organizations we work with a ton of great habitat organizations, have been successful at getting, you know, grants where we can get some pretty awesome boots on the ground habitat projects accomplished. Currently, I've got a couple of moose habitat projects that the Ruffed Grouse Society is funding, which sounds kind of funny, I think, that the Ruffed Grouse Society is funding moose projects. But if you think about it, that the habitat is really it can be pretty similar, and what benefits moose can benefit grouse and vice versa. So it's a pretty cool partnership that I just feel pretty lucky to be working on right now.
Right. Well, what can you give kind of a deeper explanation of specifically what does a habitat project look like for ruffed grouse, or this moose project that you're working on obviously will benefit both, but what is that even? I mean, there's so many conservation organizations and they say working on habitat projects, which is, I believe, sort of a blanket statement, right? We know you're doing good stuff out there, but specifically, what does that mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's something that I probably should dive into a little greater detail on.
No, it's okay. I mean, it's when I talk to everybody, I get the same thing. Like, we're working on our habitat projects, but I want to I want to understand what that means for a specific region, because it varies for pheasants, for chucker, for quail, for grouse, for woodcock, you know, and understanding the actual labor that goes into the project and where the money is spent, I think is important.
Yeah. So it could vary, for the Lasard Sam's Outdoor Heritage Council grant that the Rough Grouse mm-hmm. Society just got for us. It's called the Phase 4 Moose Habitat Collaborative Project. So this is the fourth time that we've been successful in receiving funding for that. And by we, I mean the conservation organization that stamps their name on it. I'm just lucky enough to benefit from being able to get this work done in the area that I work in. But the work that they, part of the $1.5 million that they were successful in receiving is a big chunk for timber stand improvement. So we do a lot of timber harvest up here. Our foresters do a lot of timber harvest up here, both state, county, and federal. So, you know, timber markets, wood up here, every tree is a marketable product. And, you know, it's set to be harvested at one point or another, given a large suite of considerations, but not every like clear cut of a timber stand is going to regenerate equally. There's one that I'm working on, a smaller grant right now with the Rough Grouse Society it was a stand, just to bring it down to a one stand level. It was a stand that was mm-hmm. harvested 12 years ago. And because the moose were in there so thick after it was trying to regenerate, they ate it the first year. They ate all the regrowth. Then the second year, the regrowth tried to grow again and they ate that too. So they're eating the really nutritious buds that are coming on these trees. This is a kind of a simplification again, but then maybe the third year that tries to grow again. And every time it tries to grow after it gets browsed or eaten, it grows kind of shrubbier and bushier, and it's not going to be a really very great marketable product anymore. But it's also going to be less and less nutritious for the wildlife too. So it's sort of a dual benefit to kind of restart those stands. So after 12 years of these stands getting browsed or eaten on, that it was clear that the stand just isn't going to grow back into any sort of merchantable or marketable wood, but it's also becoming less and less favorable habitat. And so we, you know, sought out a partnership and were successful in getting grant funding for us to do, we did what was called a rock raking. So that it was a dozer, during frozen ground conditions came in, and they have these teeth attached to their blade that kind of, they're not only pushing over the kind of crappy, decadent stuff that was growing, but they're kind of stirring up the soil a little bit. So birch needs, scarified, soil to really grow its best. And so, that's all kind of being accomplished through one machine that kind of makes passes and kind of sets the site back at age zero, and hopefully in better condition than right as when the timber harvest first occurred. And so then this is also in partnership with the Nature Conservancy. We're going to be planting that site finally this spring here in a couple weeks, and we'll be planting it back to a nice mix of different conifers that the native plant community kind of dictate should be there, as well as allowing birch and aspen to seed back in or regenerate as it should. So it's kind of cool.
Yeah. No, I appreciate the explanation. I'm sure every project is unique in its own way, but it's interesting to see just really the information that you guys learn about each individual project. Now, when you go and plant this and start it back at zero, what's your estimation on how long that's going to take? Well, actually, two things came to mind. Will the moose go back in again and just keep mowing it down? Or do you think it'll succeed? And if it does succeed, at what point do you feel like it's going to be at its maximum potential for rough grouse and woodcock?
Yeah, so it will get browsed again, but that's kind of the goal, because we want to always have good habitat for the moose, which includes a component of conifer for them too. So just like rough grouse, you kind of want a mosaic of different habitat types. These rough grouse and moose don't share all the same habitat requirements, but they're similar enough that we can, for simplification purposes, just say they both prefer aspen, or I shouldn't say aspen, but deciduous regrowth. Woodcock at some point are going to have a much closer relationship with the moose cover. It would be our hope, you know, and as soon as it kind of matures from there, then it turns more into the rough grouse type cover. But keeping that conifer component is going to benefit all those species as well, because the moose use it for thermal protection, both in the summer and the wintertime. And we know the rough grouse are commonly associated with conifer cover up here during the hunting season. Now, like, not every timber stand is going to regenerate at an equal or similar age. In other parts of Minnesota, an aspen stand could be great for woodcock at just, you know, 2 or 3 years old. But up here, because we have a little bit different soil types and things just regenerate a little bit slower up here, it might be 5 or 6 years old. So for a rough grouse, it could be, you know, anywhere from 8 to 20 years old could be really prime time, or in other parts of the state, it could be, you know, a little earlier than that. But, you know, we just try our best to mimic the natural disturbances that might have happened here. Some of these other grant projects are going to be paying for prescribed burning and other habitat type projects up here, just to try to return the habitat just as good a condition as we could.
So about 5 years ago, I did a story, maybe it was longer than that, maybe 6 or 7. But anyway, I did a story with Terry Ides out of Wisconsin. He has a guide service called Ides Guides, and he hunts on public lands over there near Park Falls, Wisconsin. But he also has his own property. And over the last 40 years of managing it, he said that he's kind of almost eliminated the grouse's up and down cycle, because he takes little chunks of his land every year and logs them. And it might be a 5 acre, it might be a 7 acre, it might be a 8 acre, it might be 12 acres, but it's constantly moving. And so the grouse have old growth, new growth, middle-aged growth. They have all of that in their short or their small little territory. And he said in all of the years he's been managing his land, he's only had 1 year where he saw the grouse cycle dip to a point where he said he didn't want to go hunt for them. But he believes that his managing style has given the grouse ideal conditions to thrive every single year. Do you feel like that is true? I mean, do you feel like that's something that could be done, or do the grouse go through their cycle regardless of what we do?
That's a really good question. The grouse cycle is so, it's hard to put your finger on these days in particular, because our spring weather has been so different the last, even 5 years. Last year was great. We had an early melt. We had some rain right away, but then it remained dry through the entirety of the nesting season. And we ended up having a really fantastic hatch for the most part. But, you know, in other years, we might get 2 feet of snow in May. And so the weather in the springtime is going to dictate hatch success, but habitat is ultimately what it's going to come down to as far as keeping birds on the landscape and keeping birds healthy. You know, you got to have a mix of different species. You can't just have one monoculture, because they're going to feed on different things at different times. You know, you need your fruiting shrubs. You need good places where insects are going to grow, the catkin type shrubs and trees in the wintertime. So birch and hazel and things like that, just keeping food sources, year round food sources in mind when you're thinking about habitat. But that all just comes down to kind of keeping a diverse habitat, both in terms of age, species composition, and structure. And you can't really stress that enough, is to kind of keeping things diverse is to keep things healthy, really.
Right. So we can look at, you know, Minnesota, Michigan, Wisconsin, look at areas where we're still managing the habitat. Then you move over to places like Pennsylvania, you know, and they're not logging anymore. And what are their bird numbers doing over there? I mean, can you look at a direct correlation and say, this is why it's important for us to harvest timber and do these kind of projects, because without it, we wouldn't have the birds that we have today?
Probably. I mean, somebody who is more familiar with all the different, like, exactly those numbers of maybe birds per acre, birds per mile, mm-hmm. and it could tie that into, like, timber harvest levels, or, you know, maybe just the, like, forest inventory based on age or species could probably, a study could certainly be done to look at that, but it's also just anecdotally pretty obvious when you're looking at bird numbers, I think.
So the grouse are drumming right now. How long will they continue drumming? And are you part of doing drumming counts yourself for the DNR?
Yeah. Yep. Yep. Survey work is one of my favorite kind of seasonal things I get to do as part of my job, is all the different surveys for all the different species that we historically survey for. So we'll be doing our rough grouse drumming counts here pretty soon. Those surveys are set based off of when we think there's a specific dates that we should be going out and surveying during, but it's kind of up to us when we think that drumming is at its peak. And then we also in the springtime have our singing ground surveys, which is the woodcock surveys. And those dates are set based on latitude more or less and very specific weather conditions. But they started last week, I think. And once I feel like they're really drumming away, I haven't been hearing them, you know, once I hear them kind of all day and all night, I might think, well, we're probably at our peak and go do my drumming counts for the year. And that'll, you know, the drumming count is just an index survey of really just the males that were able to overwinter. So it's not going to tell us what the population will be like coming into the fall. We can make inferences based on the weather or what we think. Go ahead.
Sorry, we have a little bit of a connection there. But once you go out to start your drumming count, do you have a certain territory that you wouldn't want to cross into somebody else's territory, or how does that work?
Oh, the routes are set. Historically, we still run the same routes that we have for the last several decades. So that's by design. The timber, the age changes of those, but it's also expected that some of them are going to get old whilst others are being harvested. So they should be continuously kind of growing older and getting reset at the same, you know, all along one timber route, one drumming route.
Gotcha. So is that open to the public as well? If I wanted to sign up and say, hey, put me down as a drummer counter, can I do that? Or is that strictly employee only?
Yeah, it's still done by agency employees. We have a spruce grouse survey that we started back in 2018 in the spruce grouse range. And we do have volunteers running those survey routes for us.
How many volunteers do you have? Do you know?
Ooh, that's a good question. And I don't know. It's always fluctuating. And as you may expect with COVID, those numbers have really changed. So it's a good number of volunteers, though.
That's really cool. I like the opportunities that are available for us to stay connected to the birds in the spring. Last question here. Well, it's going to be kind of two questions. How do you feel, you know, based on what you've learned over the years now and working with the birds year in and year out, how do you feel about the woodcock population overall, where it stands today? Is it healthy? Is it growing? Is it declining? And then same thing about rough grouse. Do you feel like we're at a good place where hunters should be excited again this year? Or is there concern on your part?
Yeah, so I feel lucky that I'm able to travel kind of across Minnesota, both in the springtime during woodcock banding, as well as in the fall time during my hunting travels. And so I get to kind of see what I feel like the populations are like in other parts of the state as well. But I'm kind of stuck in my own little bubble up here in northeastern Minnesota, where I can kind of say that, you know, it all is based on the springtime and the hatch, mm-hmm. because you should be shooting the majority of the birds that you're harvesting should be young of the year. And if they're not, young of the year, then it's going to show that we had a pretty bad hatch. And then you can kind of expect there to be a few years where you need to kind of expect that that you're going to be kind of in a regrowing or regrowth type stage where it might take a couple of years before things were as good as they were before. But with having a good couple springs, as well as just really keying in on different habitat types or you know, they use different kind of cover. Minnesota is such a diverse state. And so where I am, if I'm hunting in Brainerd or up by Grand Rapids, I'm kind of looking for different covers than I am over here. And so once you key in on that, you can usually find birds most places. And I, as a rough grouse hunter, you know, you measure success in flushes versus birds in the bag. So if I can keep those numbers fairly comparable, I'm pretty happy. That being said, woodcock populations across the country, I know the 10-year has shown that they're in decline. However, in Minnesota, they usually trend more towards stable or slightly increasing depending on the
Yay.
Year.
Yay!
Yeah,
fantastic.
So it's always
positivity.
Good news.
All right. Because of you, Bailey, keep it up.
No. Lots and lots of people. Lots of people, lots of partners, for sure.
How do we get everybody else to do the same thing you're doing then?
Well, I'm not.
How do we get other states to do what Minnesota is doing to manage and help these birds thrive?
That's a great question. There needs to be, I'm sure there needs to be a market for the timber that's in that area. So we're lucky over here right now that there's still a great market for aspen, and aspen is a very marketable product. And that happens to be the kind of keystone species for the birds that we love to pursue. It's really the same across the country, depending on what game bird you're looking at, that their habitat needs to be kind of, managed specifically for their species. But that's lucky that we have such a market for aspen. And I know in other parts of the country, aspen isn't king for rough grouse, but it is here. And so as long as there's a market for whatever the species is, then we're going to be having timber harvest. So I know that's a big struggle in other parts of the country. And we struggle with that too. Everything is more expensive to deal with than it ever was before. In some cases, we're having to pay people to take wood off of these lands. There's not just an endless pot of money sitting there. So it's stressful and it is hard. Invasives are more of a problem now than they ever were before. And that's really affecting every species. But, and that's another thing that, you know, you got to find a source of money to pay for, because they don't treat themselves. So it's difficult. It really is. But as long as, you know, we can keep doing what we're doing, I'm pretty hopeful here.
Well, it seems to me, you know, hunters help pay for the conservation. It seems to me that when you sell the wood that gets harvested, that it should help pay for more conservation. But I obviously don't know enough about how that the programs work.
It does for sure. So there's a division of forestry and there's a division of wildlife, and you know, that's only with the state, with the DNR. There's, like I said, there's county and federal agencies that are also doing timber harvest, and they are putting the forested lands back into trees for sure on every single site. Some sites, you know, they're going to let regenerate. Aspen doesn't need to be planted. It regenerates back on its own when they harvest it according to their specifications, and they're very good at what they do. The foresters are, for sure. But there are these special kind of sites like that moose one I was telling you about, where they didn't really tuck away money for 12 years later when the moose were going to eat all the trees year after year. Right. And so it doesn't happen at every site, but it is, you know, it does happen once in a while where we're able to kind of enhance something that, you know, was maybe not going to be so great on its own.
Got it. Well, Bailey, I really appreciate you sharing this information. You have a wealth of knowledge. We're lucky to have you and all of the services that you're working so hard to provide. I know for a fact that it helps hunters, and you're teaching other people too. So really, honestly, thank you for everything that you're doing. I hope that your banding projects go go great in the coming weeks to get the right weather. And I know we're all pulling for the right nesting conditions so that our bird populations reach their full potential this fall as well. So once again, thank you, Bailey, for your time today. And I know you've got some projects coming up, so I'll let you get back to it.
Thanks, Travis. And thanks for what you do too. I mean, I think this podcast and all the work that you do with your show and everything is, I mean, people are seeing that, and they're definitely is helping with the recruitment too, which is a huge part of increasing license sales as well.
Well, it's teamwork, right? It's one hunter at a time. And I'm actually excited. I get to take a couple new hunters out turkey hunting this spring. So I know you're doing the exact same thing. And, you know, you're working with people training new hunters, new dogs, and then you're working with the hands-on crews to enhance the grounds that we like to hunt. So I feel like you're doing way more than I am, and you don't get to argue that. So thank you. We'll leave it at
that. All right. Thanks, Travis.
Yeah, you bet. Once again, thank you to Federal Premium Ammunition and Onyx for helping us to make this show possible. Be sure to download the Onyx Hunt app before your next hunting adventure to find out why it's one of the most helpful and most valuable hunting tools available today. All of the episodes of The Flush Television Show from our latest season are available now on our YouTube channel. Simply search for The Flush on YouTube and you'll find them in their entirety. And please subscribe to our channel so you don't miss any of the upcoming videos we plan to post. I believe last week we posted a raw video of the sharp-tailed grouse dancing on their lek. This week, I think we've got some raw cut video of rough grouse drumming on a log. Pretty cool to see. If you can't see it, wherever you live, out in the woods, happening right now, you can enjoy watching it. If you have a few seconds, we'd love to get your comments on this podcast and give it a rating. It helps us move up the ranks, and we'll let more people share in on our love for uplands and the birds. Thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next week with another episode of the Flush Podcast. I'm Travis Frank, reminding you to take the time to introduce someone new to the field.